Welcome back. The 15 in 60 turned out to be a little bit more like 15 in 120. So we decided to take this to a part two and run it on Thursday night with Danny going to be on vacation anyway. Hope you guys can deal with that. We will start it off with the Memphis Grizzlies, take you down to the San Antonio Spurs. And if you missed part one, go back and listen to that one. We talked about the Clippers and Warriors and Jazz and Rockets matchups on Wednesday, and then went through the first half of the alphabet after that. Enjoy. Memphis Grizzlies, 41-31, 4-6 in their last 10, given the personnel available. That actually is not too bad. We know that Mike Conley is out. Really, we haven't heard anything about his recovery, but it seems like they will be lucky to get him back for the playoffs. It was 3 to 4 weeks, you know, a couple of weeks ago when that was first announced. They are projected at a 45-37 record and supposed to have the number 5 seed. It would be very, very difficult for them to lose that at this point.
Right. They have a really tough schedule. I mean, so they face the Spurs twice, they face the Warriors twice, they face the Clippers, and they have to go at Dallas, and they face the Raptors. They have a lot of tough games, but they built this lead partially because Portland has lost a couple games and maybe they could have won. But so let's say Memphis only wins 3 more games the rest of the season, so they go 3-7. Portland still has to go 7-3 to tie them. And I think they would win the tiebreaker, but that's a lot to ask, considering Portland, of course, faces the Warriors in Oakland as well, and the Clippers tomorrow night.
You know what? I would only favor them in one of their remaining games with this skeleton crew at home against Denver, and even that is no cakewalk. Like, is very possible. I mean, granted, they've been playing okay, but I think teams like this, that yeah, they're kind of getting by on guile and coaching and effort. They've been offensive rebounding like crazy, since that's sort of the only way for them to get anything done with the lack of shooting that they have. But they have a lot of guys who are good rebounders on the offensive end for their position. Tony Allen, Lance Stevenson, Matt Barnes, obviously Zach Randolph. But I think that the glass slipper could shatter for them at any time, and they could very easily go win like 1 or 2 games the rest of the year. But they have so much of a lead that Portland would have to win, you know, like 8-3, 7-4 or something, even to tie them. I think that's looking pretty darn unlikely. So they've built enough of a cushion here somehow that even though they would have probably a historically bad point differential for a number 5 seed in a conference, it looks like that's how it's going to turn out.
Which means, considering what we said earlier, that it's prohibitively likely that we will get a Clippers-Grizzlies series. Hooray.
Who has more reason for revenge, Lance Stevenson or Jeff Green?
What reason does Jeff Green have for revenge?
I don't know. They traded him.
They traded him. But, I mean, they gave him a chance. They tried him in the starting lineup. They tried him at the 4. They did a bunch of different stuff. And they got a first-round pick for him. It's not like Lance, where you basically gave up a first-round pick for the other dude. And he got exiled to the bench. And, you know, Rock Divers traded for him and then was unhappy with him. And so I think Lance has it. And one of the kind of hilarious things about that potential series is that while I think the Clippers have a substantial advantage when the starters are on the court, I think in some ways it's kind of a rich man, poor man's version of similar teams, point guard driven. DeAndre, of course, won't have Marc Gasol as his counterpoint. But Memphis, I think, has a meaningfully better bench right now. And Lance Stevenson is a big part of that.
Yeah, I see no way that they win that series, even without Blake Griffin. Although, and Doc was said he's still not sure that he's going to be back, and especially when you tack 4 games on to whenever it is that he's supposed to return, and I'm not sure what would happen to his suspension if he gets into the playoffs, whether that would carry over to next year or not. But
yeah, I don't know how that works.
It is a little troubling that he's not even being talked about as like getting close or practicing at this point. We haven't even heard about that yet for Blake Griffin.
Wait, one thing, I'm pretty sure this is unrealistic and ridiculous, but the hypothetical of it just made me laugh in my head of if, let's say, the Clippers were up 3-0 and for whatever reason, Blake's suspension did extend into the playoffs. And so he hadn't come back in time. So they're losing games on purpose just to get his suspension out of the way before they have to face their second round series.
Manipulating the standings and the matchups in any way is just like your favorite topic, isn't it?
It's up there.
Tony Allen has been awesome since he came back from injury. Another reason why you might say that their performance is not sustainable, that for him to go 12 out of 12 from the field and score 27 points against the Lakers, is actually the first game he had ever matched up with Kobe Bryant and outscored him. Kobe had 20 last night. But they still lost that game at the Lakers. That's part of why you start to think that, hey, pretty much every game left on their schedule is losable for them. But Tony Allen, it's just a reminder, especially guys who are wings and guards, of what skill levels even a guy like Tony Allen, who's viewed as such an albatross last year, has. But I think for, and you know, he scored 20 points a game when he was in college, right? And when you come into the league, it's better off to learn how to play a role, and he's done that. But confidence and just the license to play with freedom is something that can still be very powerful for some of these NBA players, even if you look at them as a rung or two below someone who should be generating offense for your team. It's easy to forget that these guys have all generated offense basically for their teams at very high levels before they come into the league. And sometimes guys will have skills that can be reawakened if they are required. A lot of times not, but in this case, it's been a nice story for us.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's always nice to see that and appreciate how much talent these guys have, even if it's not their listed strength, let's say.
Today's show is brought to you by the SeatGeek app. SeatGeek is the best place on the internet to buy and sell tickets. It is the best place on your phone to buy and sell tickets as well, because they aggregate together all of the online ticket buying options. You don't have to worry that you might have missed out on a better deal on some other site. Now it's all at your fingertips using the SeatGeek app. And SeatGeek is also a great way to sell tickets as well. They have a proprietary metric called Deal Score, which tells you if you are buying whether it is a good deal. Green is good, red perhaps not so good. And if you're selling, they give you a suggested selling point as well, so you can make a fair price without having to put a ton of research into it. So whether buying or selling, SeatGeek is an amazing app, the most convenient way to buy or sell tickets on the internet. And first-time users, listeners of the show, may use the code CAPSPACE, all one word. Go into the settings tab on the app, click on add a promo code, put in that CAPSPACE code, and you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Once you make the purchase, they will send you your $20. That's the CAPSPACE code in the settings tab on the SeatGeek app. The Minnesota Timberwolves, are they going to fulfill your prediction that you made like a month ago that they wouldn't win 10 more games?
Right now they're projected to finish at exactly what would be exactly 10 wins. They beat Sacramento tonight because they sat DeMarcus Cousins, and I'm a little bit bitter about that. Though, of course, I root for every team to do well. So they're projected for a 27-55 record. I believe they had 17 wins when I said they wouldn't win 10 more. So that's the way it is. And I actually had proposed to you, and I think we're going to do it, for Minnesota to do a little bit of a game, especially because we both watched that game against the Warriors a little bit more closely, though I find myself watching Minnesota kind of a lot. And so the game is basically this player, and we'll do different guys, would be the blank best player on a good team when he is, you can use either 25 or in his prime, just kind of an idea of like when they're a grown up, let's say.
Yeah, so a good team, when we say a good team, let's say, you know, a top 4 seed in a conference, you know, 55 win type of team. I think that is what most general managers would aspire to make their team into. That's when you can start to say, all right, we have at least a shot here once you're winning 55 games that, you know, we could be one move away, or that we could catch some breaks in the playoffs, or maybe everything goes right for us like it did for the Hawks last year and we win 60. You know, so that's kind of what you're shooting for, is a 55 win team. So let's start with Karl Towns.
Best player on a good team.
Yeah, that was easy. Andrew Wiggins.
I know they're probably hoping for first or second. I'm leaning towards third or fourth best, so still a starter, still a clear-cut starter, but not really the leader of the offense or the defense.
Yeah, he has the ability physically to be the type of two-way player. You know, he's more physically talented than Kawhi Leonard is. He's probably a better natural shooter right now. Kawhi Leonard was still in college bricking threes for San Diego State at this time. Andrew's bricking threes for the Wolves instead, but at least they're NBA threes and his form looks fine. He has that level of physical talent. So could be, you'd probably say, second. Would be fourth, fifth, just because he has not shown the ability to impact winning really in any measurable way. And, you know, maybe if they get a real coaching staff in there, that could change in a big hurry. But for right now, the path that he's on, even though he's scoring 20 points a game, and that's, we never look at points per game anymore, but he's scoring 20 points a game in his second year. Like, that's pretty good, right? But, you know, it's, a lot of that's just that he's taking a lot of shots. He's not particularly efficient, and he does nothing else on the floor other than score.
Yeah, and his defense is going to have to grow a lot for him to even get into that, you know, fourth best player range, because you can look at even somebody like Harrison Barnes, who's been a little bit disappointing, but you need to bring effort consistently on that end if your offense isn't going to be there as an efficiency standpoint.
Exactly. I mean,
you could make an argument from anywhere from fourth to seventh, I think. Maybe you could go a little bit lower if you're low on him, but him playing off the ball, I think he has value. He's a terror in the open court. He can, I trust that he can hit open shots. He still sucks defensively, but he's worse than he used to, I mean, he's better than he used to be, which is a nice thing. So I could see him as, you know, being, if you could afford to have your, if you had a guy who can run your offense at the one, you had another guy who's your lead scorer, so he's kind of the number three offensive option, fourth or fifth defensive option, I could see him as a starter on a good team.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. And maybe I think his most likely destiny is probably a high-scoring sixth man. I think that's great transition player and decent shooter, guy who probably takes some bad shots, but maybe you could use those bad shots on your second unit when you don't have a ton of scoring. So I think probably, you know, sometimes that player can be the fourth best player on your team, even though he's not starting.
Yep.
So I think that's probably right about right.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to mention with him is he's a guy, I think, that will probably get pigeonholed into that at some point in his career, but I think he's a lot better with better surrounding talent. So he could be somebody who ends up as a sixth man, but actually would play better, whether that be like a Manu role where he closes games playing with the starters, because he's not good enough at creating in half court sets, but if he's not, doesn't have to do that, I think he'll do fine.
Yeah. Another way to kind of think about this is, and this would be, might be instructive with Gorgui Dieng too, is, all right, he's a center and he's pretty close to fully formed now at 25, 26 years old. What is he? Maybe like the 25th best center in the league right now. You know, maybe he grows to become the 20th best. So if you're the 20th best center, then you're probably the fifth or sixth best player on a good team, the 55 win team, right? Like, you're, maybe you can start for them, but you'll play 20 or 25 minutes and the rest of the starters are kind of better players than you are. You know, I think that's sort of what I view as Dang's destiny. He has shown the ability to play a little bit of four and shoot it well enough that he wouldn't be just a complete disaster. I still think you would want him as a five, because he's, unless he can extend his range out to the 3-point line. And even then, he's not someone who's ever going to put the ball on the floor as well. He just would be a standstill shooter as a four, so not that huge of a threat. So yeah, I think, you know, maybe fifth best player on a good team, sixth best player. That's kind of what I see for Dieng.
I've been very impressed with him in terms of the idea of growing beyond being just a backup center. I mean, that was what I had kind of thought of him for a long time, was that he'd be a solid, you know, first center off the bench. But I think his ability to slide over and play a little bit of four and play with good players, you know, play with Karl Towns has helped him a lot. So yeah, he could do that, you know, play, let's say, 24 minutes a game on a good team. I could certainly see him doing, playing primarily five, but dancing a little bit to the four, just because he's worthy of more minutes and you want the right constituent talent with him. But I think you can make that work.
Shabazz Muhammad.
7th to 10th, something in that range, like a scorer off the bench. I don't think he's reliable enough defensively that you're doing that, but if he's coming off the bench, there aren't many teams that are playing a scorer, particularly if he plays the three, that you're going to be like, oh my God, we have to have somebody on the floor who can do that. It's actually the KJ McDaniels problem. I've never really talked about this before, but so I think he can play a part on it, but I don't think he's going to be a starter on a good team.
Yeah, with Shabazz, you kind of run into the could versus would conundrum as well. I think would, you know, eighth, ninth man, something like that. Could, sixth, fifth, you know, another guy who could be a good scorer off the bench, has okay tools, but just the track that he's on right now, there's just no indication that he contributes to winning basketball. How about Ricky Rubio?
Fourth or fifth. I think he's a definite starter in the league, though I think I don't think it's going to be hard for a team to win a championship with him, just because his flaws are very exploitable unless he randomly makes threes like he does like once or twice a year. But he can be that on a good team, because when he's on the floor, he's a very good underrated defender and he can run an offense. So he has these flaws, but his strengths to me supersede those for a guy of his caliber.
He's getting to be pretty much at his prime right now. Could get better maybe as a shooter. He's someone who I think as a big point guard might do better as he ages than some other guys might have a little bit later of a prime if he can improve the shooting. We've been waiting for that since he was 17, but, you know, maybe it'll happen still. And I think his ceiling is maybe an average point guard, the 15th best point guard. And if you think about it, all right, if you have five starters who are the 15th best player at their position, then you've got an average team, theoretically, right? So if you want to have a good team, then you better have three players who are better than an average starter, you know, and so that would make him fourth or fifth best player on a good team.
Yeah, and he's a guy you don't really see this much at center. I've talked about the DeMarcus Cousins thing about pulling a guy early and playing against backups. Rubio, if you had another good point guard, could actually be the counterpoint to that, where he plays more against starters because he's a good defender, and then you have somebody else who's a little bit maybe more of a scorer who can start and then play a little bit with the backups.
Tyus Jones.
I don't really have a feel for him yet. You know, I from what I've seen, he could be a backup, but I haven't seen anything that screams starter to me, like what he does that nobody can stop. I haven't seen that yet.
He's shooting well from three-point range. I think he's a good passer and operator in the pick and roll. Has enough size and athleticism that he shouldn't be a massive liability on defense. I think it's the most likely outcome is that he's a backup. I think he could be a quality backup. So, you know, seventh best guy, eighth best guy, something like that.
Yeah, that seems fair.
New Orleans, 26 and 44, 3 and 6 in their last nine, and a 32 and 50, 538 projected record. You would have to imagine that them winning six more games would be very unlikely, with one good NBA player basically playing for them now, with Ryan Anderson out and Anthony Davis out. If you want to hear more about the Pelicans and their future and their various injuries, I recorded a podcast with Justin Verrier yesterday, ESPN's Pelicans reporter. So go back and listen to that one. There has been some more news, though, and some more writing about what AD's diagnosis is, and it's not particularly encouraging.
No, it's not. Do you want to talk? I think you probably read it more than I did, Jeff Stotz's article.
Yeah, so the tendinosis diagnosis is basically often confused with tendinitis, but it's worse. It's basically sort of tendinitis that has become a chronic problem due to overuse, lack of treatment, etc. It is similar. It sounds like the procedure that AD is going to have is pretty similar to what Carmelo Anthony had, and that was an injury that took him longer than he thought to get back this year, and he had even missed some more games with knee soreness this year. The procedure is probably going to be a debridement, where they basically take out scar tissue in the patellar tendon, and that takes a long while to get back from. Danny Granger, he had some other problems too, he's kind of damaged goods, but this is the surgery that basically took him from being a good player to not being a good player. This is a real surgery, and something that I think is a little bit concerning, especially for a guy who's this young. I can't recall someone this young having a procedure like this. It seems like one of those things that happens when you're like 29 or 30, or is supposed to. So this is another black mark in that Pelicans training staff's ledger, and it is at least a little bit of a question now. I mean, I don't think AD's career is going to be over or anything like that, but whether that amazing athleticism that was really the most important part of his game could now be at least slightly compromised. And given the way he's played this year, now having the surgery, this was a guy who was on track to potentially be one of the greatest players ever, a top 20 talent ever in NBA history. And I think given the events of this past year, you would now have to say that that outcome is unlikely.
Yeah, and you're going to have to be patient with him with this kind of a thing. And in a way, fortunately for New Orleans, it's not like they have this bright season next season coming in front of them where they're like, oh my God, we're going to have him for 82 games to have a chance. They can be patient, but they haven't shown that willingness recently.
Well, and the other problem is, you are, in some respects, a creature of your surrounding, both from health. You know, he could easily get injured again. That's been the pattern of Pelicans players to a large degree in these last, you know, 5 years or whatever it's been. The coaching around him, the organization, has not been good so far. The players around him to really maximize his talents, to make him become an all-time great talent. Again, you have to question whether they're ever going to be able to get that sort of a team around him. So all of that, it's not just that, you know, he hasn't played as well and he has these health questions. It's also just that I think it soured on this team now to where they were seen as up and coming. You thought that there was a scenario they could win 55 games this year, and they obviously are going to fall well short of that.
Yeah, well short of that.
Oklahoma City, 49-22. They have righted the ship with a 6-2 performance in their last eight games, including some really nice wins. They are now projected right about where they were at the back of the All-Star break before that bad stretch, 56-26. they will be the number three seed almost certainly.
And they, I was found interesting. 538 gives them a 4% chance of the title. How does that feel to you?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it feels a little low to me, but not super low. Maybe like 5-6%.
Oh, you think it should be higher?
I think it should be higher, yeah.
Yeah, the fact that they have to go through... All right, so let's do it this way. What percent chance do you give them of losing in the first round? To either the Jazz or the Rockets or the Blazers?
10%.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, because they could easily have injuries,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
that's
true.
Maybe that's how that's priced in. All right, okay, so 10%. What percent chance do you give them of losing to the Spurs?
70.
Oh, I would put it even 75, and that Spurs team is awesome.
Yeah, they are.
They're going to have home court. I think, you know, you want to put in 5% chance just for injury or something of a team winning, just, you know, sort of the, like, you get 200 points on the SAT just for writing your name down. But I think, all right, so 25, 30% chance.
Well, yeah, and then all we right, could even not... skip ahead, and, I mean, they wouldn't be, like, these huge favorites in the finals. I would have them as favorites over the Cavs, but not by a ton.
Right, that's the point, right? Take your percent chance of getting past the Warriors and Spurs, which, granted, we would feel they were a lot more formidable if they did that. Afterwards, they'd probably be pretty big favorites against the Cavs, but probably not, you know, more than 60, 70% favorites. So you add up all those percentages, yeah, you know, you're getting to about 4%. I think that's like that's a pretty fair odds now that we think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I guess.
A couple guys I wanted to talk about that I looked at for this week. Deion Waiters, surprisingly bad in transition, actually. He shoots only 43% on transition opportunities. He is in the 11th percentile. I can't understand why that would be, just because you would think that a lot of that would just be runouts against, he's playing with a guy who likes to push the ball and Russell Westbrook. He's got KD filling the lane on the other side of him. Granted, some of those are probably when those two guys are out of the game, but he actually turns it over 21% of the time. And when he's had actually 147 possessions this year in transition, that's a lot, 20% of his offense. So that's really bad. He's also a guy who was hopefully brought in to be a third playmaker for this team. He is averaging only 0.66 points per possession as the ball handler in pick and roll. That is horrible when he usually will just pull up for a bad fadeaway on those shots, 27th percentile in that. The one thing that he is good at, play types, is spotting up, which is surprising. He's actually always been a pretty decent catch and shoot guy, which kind of belies his reputation. But and he actually has a below average usage now for this Oklahoma City team. So if he's not doing all this other stuff that he's bad at, if he's just going to spot up, that's just not enough to really be a threat. And then also on shots around the basket, he's in the 12th percentile in the league. He shoots about 50% around the basket. And he's age 24, getting pretty darn close to being what he is at this point, and what he is a waste of a traded away first round draft pick.
And to compound all that, it's not like I think his defensive foibles can be overstated at times, but he's not making up for those flaws on the other end to be the most charitable about it.
Yeah, he's had some good moments.
Sure.
Defensively, like in the game in Oakland, the first game in Oakland, he did a nice job on Klay Thompson, for example. He does have some okay defensive tools. He's strong. He can at least switch and hold up okay that way. But yeah, he's not a stopper, obviously. Kevin Durant also looked a little bit more closely at kind of what's different about him, both under Billy Donovan and in his last MVP healthy year in 2014. He is shooting. We're seeing some very subtle signs of slippage in his game as he gets to be 27 rather than 25. And also, you know, he missed a year. Very close. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's been very close to the height of his powers, but he's shooting 74% at the rim. You're like, oh, that's unbelievable. Shot 80% at the rim in 2013-14. And just subjectively had a ton of spectacular dunks that year. We haven't seen really that much of that from him this year. And he's also being used a little bit differently.
Yeah, so I was surprised that he's playing less power forward this year. That's been kind of the thing that we've all been hoping for. And, you know, I haven't noticed it as really being much more or much less, but it was still surprising me.
Yeah, 21% of the time per Basketball Reference at power forward this year compared to 25% his last two healthy years, last year and this year, the last two Brooks years. And it's not surprising in some respects because they have put a lot more resources into the big positions. You know, it's Enes Kanter, who they're paying a max contract to, and Steven Adams, who was a high draft pick and, you know, starts for them. And then obviously Serge Ibaka is really good. So between those three guys, it seems like they have most of the big man minutes used up, and I think a lot of the time when he's played the four has been sort of desperate comeback attempt type of situations. So, and also just their bigs are better than their wings are, right? Like they're struggling to even find one two-way wing next to KD. If you play him at the four, now you need to get two. So it makes more sense to just because their bigs are just better players than their wings are. But structurally, Durant is a guy who can protect the basket a little bit with his length. Very good defensive rebounder for a small forward. Someone that you would hope could play the four more, but just they've not really built their roster to enable that to happen. And so I don't blame Billy Donovan. I would blame management for the fact that he's not playing for the four more.
Yeah, especially this year, the issue is personnel. I mean, we just talked about the disappointment of Dion Waiters, and their other guys are similarly disappointing, at least for the most part. They don't even have, like, a real natural three of all of those other guys. More of them, to me, are more of naturally defensively or shooting guards.
Yeah. Singler is what? Is he like a, like...
Oh, I don't count him.
Yeah, yeah. More on the sort of subtle changes in his game front. He's basically moved 4% of his shots from inside of 10 feet out to beyond the three-point line this year, and hasn't really affected his overall efficiency, but it does show, and maybe part of that too is the fact that he's playing more with bigs, there's less space on the floor, but I think it also just shows the athleticism is not quite as much there. He hasn't been attacking off the dribble as much. He's been pulling up for three more, but the overall result is still obviously, you know, the guy that I ranked second in the league on my top 10 players.
We both did.
Last week.
Phoenix Suns, 20-51, 3-5 since the last time we did this, and they are projected to win three more games, so they would go 23-59, which would actually put them, according to 538, a little bit ahead of the Brooklyn Nets, which I'm sure Celtics fans would be happy about.
Yeah, they will be happy about that. Devin Booker has been the one bright spot for this team, and I dug into his performance a little bit more. The scouting report on him, for one, is you want to really run him off the three-point line. His numbers shooting spot-ups are much better than when he is forced to put it on the floor and drive out of on a closeout. So you really want to fly at him and close him down. You know, as long as he's not going to take one escape dribble and shoot a three on you, which is probably something that he's going to really incorporate into his game. One thing that was really unexpected for him is that 25% of his plays have been used as a pick and roll ball handler. And part of that has been due to their myriad point guard injuries. But the problem for him is he's not really a three, and now you have all these resources already invested in eight-figure yearly contracts to Brandon Knight and Eric Bledsoe. Booker is young enough and has enough potential that I think he needs to start. He can't play three, though. Which of those guys needs to go?
Brandon Knight.
What about Bledsoe's health concerns, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think you... God, it seems like I'm a broken record with this. Of course, you listen on everybody, but the problem is Bledsoe is your pathway to being a legit team. Like, if your goal is to be, let's say, a consistent playoff team, I don't trust a Knight, Booker backcourt to get there right now. But, you know, if somebody makes a stupid offer, you, of course, consider it. But, and also, I think that eventually the Booker-Bledsoe combination, especially if Booker can do a little bit more off the dribble, I think just from a ball-sharing perspective, I think that could work pretty nicely.
Knight, in some ways, is actually more tradable than Bledsoe. There's the injury issues. There's the fact that he actually is under contract for four more years. You can view that as positive or negative. You probably view it as a positive. He's fairly paid, I would say. I mean, he's also struggled with some injuries as well, but nothing as chronic as Bledsoe with his cartilage issues. And Knight has the advantage of working on a team that has some pretty good guys who are handling the ball already on the wing because of his shooting ability. He's, you know, high 30s, 40% three-point shooter. So I think he would be very solid in, say, Utah, although they believe in Dante Exum, but they're going to have so much space that you think they might as well pick him up and see if Exum works out. And if he doesn't, you can keep Knight. If he does, then you can trade him away again once their guys start getting expensive. He would be fantastic going back to Milwaukee. That's probably unrealistic. But now that Giannis has emerged as a pick-and-roll ball handler, maybe, you know, they would consider that. You probably would have to see some sort of a regime change there, though, because I think Kidd just didn't like his lack of vision. I think that Knight would be excellent in Orlando next to guys like Victor Oladipo, who can handle the ball a little bit. He's been hot lately, and so Knight could play off the ball a little bit more. Or even play next to Alfred Payton as well. You could go with like a three-guard rotation with those guys, get some more shooting on the floor. New York he would be good as a kind of jump shooting guard who doesn't get to the basket all that well in the artificially stilted triangle environs there, but he would be a nice fit as, you know, somewhat of a bigger guard too. So I don't know. What would you be willing to give up for him were you one of those teams, for example?
Yeah, that's a big part of the problem because he's properly paid, so the idea of surplus value is more just compared to what he's, you know, compared to the guys that are going to be around there. So if you talk about Orlando, like his contract and Evan Fournier's contract could be somewhat similar, I think.
Yeah, what about like a sign and trade with him and Evan Fournier?
Well, don't you think of Fournier?
I guess Fournier
too.
Yeah, he's tall enough, but yeah, he can't play any defense. I mean, the Suns just desperately need someone who can play some defense on the wing. I mean, that's been a problem for the last 3 years. I mean, PJ Tucker tries and competes and is strong, but he really is probably better even guarding fours at this point, and he's also, you know, not adequate to start offensively either, and is probably not quick enough to really keep up with the best threats on the wing either.
Well, my guess is that Phoenix is going to try to make it work with the three of them. I mean, they're all three good players unless they get a really good offer, and so, but I think that could actually work to their advantage because they're not going to do anything, let's say, before the draft. I think that's unrealistic, and so there's going to be enough money out there that if you can trade him for, let's say, you know, like a maybe a Shabazz Muhammad type level guy, so a guy who's probably going to be a backup, and then a low first round pick, I think that would be a nice little offer for both sides, and then that would maybe go into a summer where the Suns can actually potentially be more fruitful in terms of their spending. So moving him maybe around the deadline or even maybe in that span between, so let's say early January could be an interesting time for him.
Yeah, and they have plenty of needs on this team.
Yeah.
Even with TJ Warren coming back, I wouldn't want to rely on him to start. He's not a great fit as a defender next to Booker, who I think has a ways to go as a defender. That's probably the best you can say about him, you know, and his tools. I don't think see him being much more than an average defensive player. So, yeah, I mean, anybody with some athleticism who can defend at the three or the four would be kind of what I'd be looking for. Maybe even a guy that you can sort of convince train him to shoot a little bit. I did do a little film study on Booker, and one thing that actually really surprised me was that he's very effective posting up. Another thing that you wouldn't expect from a 19-year-old rookie, but what they've been doing is they'll run some 1-2 pick and rolls and then get the switch, like when he's guarded by someone like Lou Williams, Marcel Huertas, Leandro Barbosa, he would post them up. And it's not the type of plays that you would expect either. You know, he's not just like turning and shooting right over the guys. He just backs them down and puts them in the goal and either gets fouled or shoots a layup. He had like 20 of those possessions and he didn't take a shot outside of 15 feet on any of those. So that's actually a nice little weapon to have where you can just run a 1-2 pick and roll that everybody's just going to switch as a matter of course, especially because with his shooting ability, if you don't switch it, that's going to be an open three. And then he just can back dudes down. It's actually a nice little wrinkle that they could go to a couple of times a game. I was impressed by
it. I love that. And when you get to that level where teams can't really leave you alone, one of the things that you want to develop are counters to that. So that could be, you know, how you're going to handle when they close on you hard. So an escape dribble or something like that. And a post up is another way to do that. It's actually something that Klay Thompson has done well. But that's good to hear about Booker because using the physical advantage is also something that if they have to double, I think it can be hard to counter. And if he can pass out of it, that makes it another level.
Portland, 37-35, 4-4 since our last look at them. They are projected for a 43-39 record and the number 6 seed per 538.
Yeah, so their schedule is a little bit softer than they're in a kind of a nice spot in terms of getting up there. I mentioned the idea that if Memphis falls off, they could, if they rattled off a real hot streak, they could get up to the 5. But it's going to take a whole hell of a lot. But they've been fine. I wish that they'd, you know, gotten a couple of games, particularly the one in Dallas. But they've been a good team so far. And I think one of the guys who's been important to their success, not obviously the linchpin, is Alan Crabb.
Yeah, Crabb will be a restricted free agent this year after his third season. This is the first that he's really played. He's actually fourth on this team in minutes, which is something that surprised me. Al-Farouq Aminu was third, and then obviously CJ and Dame, those are the only two guys averaging over 28 minutes on this team. And I think the fact that they have kept everyone fresh and they have these young legs has been great for them, especially when they play at home. They can really get energized. Crabb, he's great at spotting up and getting out in transition. He is excellent cutting without the ball in his hands. But when he has to make the play, he has not been effective at all. Even when, and I consider that coming off screens and trying to shoot, it's kind of making the play as well. That's really kind of you making it still coming off screens, using your shooting ability, losing your guy. He hasn't been good at that. Has not been good as a pick and roll ball handler either. Hasn't been good on handoffs, which is basically the same thing as a pick and roll in today's modern game, because you basically create a pick and roll out of that play on the wing. But he also only has 16% usage. So to really get a little bit more valuable, to move beyond kind of being a half, I mean, he's got the three part down. He's got maybe half of the D down. He's like okay on D. He really is going to have to improve his ball skills a little bit, or improve his release to where he can get more jumpers off. But I think he's a guy who right now is an okay third wing on a decent team, and maybe with the upside with his shooting and, you know, decent defense, to become a starter. So what is that player worth these days?
My guess for a little bit now has been that his starting salary is going to be around $9 million first year.
Yeah, at age 23, I mean, he's a guy who can grow into that contract. You would imagine...
God, that has to make Will Barton so mad.
Well, Will Barton wasn't as good last year as Crabbe is this year.
That's true.
You know, that's part of it.
Yeah, I was going to mention before, I really like Crabbe as a tertiary offensive option, and I think that defensively he's good enough to make that work. You just have to have the right personnel around it. I actually like him, depending on how your system works. I think he can do well with starters. You just have to have the right, you know, you have to have the right players. But he can do that. And, you know, he can do it off the bench too. But I think he needs so much creation, and most teams have substantially better creators on their top line than their second line.
Yeah, he's a tough fit playing in the starting lineup with Dame and CJ, because neither of those guys can guard bigger power wings. If you've got a big scoring wing threat on the other team, someone like Gordon Hayward, LeBron, Carmelo, KD, Crabbe doesn't have the size or the heft to really guard those guys effectively. Now you could have Aminu guard those guys and cross match or something. You know, there are definitely times where Crabbe has closed games for them in the right matchup. But for them, he's kind of always going to be destined, I think, to be a bench guy. And that might go into their thinking a little bit, but it's kind of too bad for them that he is not a free agent next year, because he has that low cap hold. He could enable them to really get into the free agent market, and then they re-sign him and they increase their spending power. But the problem is they would have to spend up to the cap this year, which, you know, they might not be able to do while giving out good contracts. So they may kind of end up having to waste this opportunity of his low capital just because there isn't enough out there on the market for them to spend wisely on.
This is going to be in a piece that comes out next week, but I think one place that I thought of as a fit for an offer sheet for Crabbe is Indiana. I think he'd be a real nice fit next to their two starters.
Yeah, I agree with you. And then they could kind of slide Ellis into more of a bench role, which they still wouldn't do, but they could. Yeah, I mean, there are a ton of teams that could use a two guard who doesn't suck on defense and can make threes. You know, I mean, that's and who knows, with Portland armed with plenty of space, maybe he gets more than $10 million. You know, it would not shock me if that were to happen. Last note on Portland: Damian Lillard is averaging 25.8 points a game this year.
Wow,
it's a lot of points, and he's doing it efficiently as well. If I had to guess, I would have thought he was averaging like 22 or 23 or something. Like 26 points a game, that is a lot of points, especially for a point guard.
Yeah, who has responsibility to create for other guys, and he does a good job of it.
Sacramento. Oof. A putrid 2-8 in their last 10, 27-44, 32-50 projected record per 538. I would say that is probably way too good, considering their tanking incentives, and also the fact that Cousins is injured, who knows when he'll be back, the fact that they are just completely imploding anyway, whether they're trying to win or not. I would think that they are looking pretty, I mean, I think they're, if you go by the projection right now, they are projected to have the sixth pick in the draft.
Yeah, and they actually...
And how crazy is that when we thought about them, you know, they were actually tied, they had sole possession of eighth place in the West in like mid-January.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, one of those early season, oh, look at that, they're, you know, 20 games in, they're doing that. It was closer to the halfway point than I think we sometimes remember, and they had that really nice stretch. And as listeners of the show know, both of us are actually pretty obsessed with pick protection, and this one has clarified a lot over the time, because yeah, they're in the middle of this kind of clump where the so basically their pick is top 10 protected, and considering how unlikely it is for a team to jump out of the to jump out of from 11 or beyond into the top, they basically would need to finish 11th. And right now the 11 is the Bucks, which is the last team in that group. We both talked about how if the Mavericks miss the playoffs, they might have the 12th seed. So the Bucks right now, they're 30-42. They're projected to get to 35 wins. So you're like, oh, that's not that great, but that's still a whole lot better than where the Kings are right now.
Yeah, and now, of course, this has some consequences. One is that the pick doesn't go to Chicago. Another one is that they could potentially swap with Philly if they get a top three pick. Now, there is at least a limited downside risk, because Philly, as the number one seed in the lottery, if they do get into the top three, the worst they would have to swap out is four with Philly. But they could also lose a chance at Ben Simmons, you know, who I think we haven't gotten into the draft stuff too much. I know Draft Express has Ingram number one. Everyone else seems to think it's Simmons. But nonetheless, Simmons, I think, is kind of viewed as the more potentially transformational talent. Yeah, that would be bad. And then also, if they don't give up the Chicago pick, it is not necessarily guaranteed that the 2019 pick will be unprotected, because they could also not give it up next year, the Chicago pick, and then they could send it in 2018. But for those who don't remember, the Philly pick that they sent, in addition to swap rights these next 2 years, is 1 through 10 protected in 2018 and then totally unprotected in 2019, the year, as we often said, that DeMarcus Cousins will no longer be on the team, most likely, since he can be a free agent at the conclusion of the 2018 season.
Yeah, I think that's kind of enough on protection for right now. But one thing that you had noted...
It's never enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm the one who's pumping the brakes on that, that's saying something. But one thing that you noticed was that they, you know, the whole storyline of certain guys that they were playing well with, Willie Cauley-Stein was one of them, a guy who I really liked going into the draft, and that has kind of fallen off the table.
Yeah, overall, since 121, when they had sole possession of eighth, it was basically the halfway mark of the season. Since then, -4.8 net rating. They're playing well with Willie on the floor. He now is second worst on the team in that time period, -10.2 net rating. Marco Bellinelli, another guy who was acquired during this offseason that we graded an F in our offseason grades. He is the only one with a worse net rating. That's -11.3. So, hey, you know, they gave away all these future assets, but at least they were good this year, right? It was worth it.
Yeah, we Kings fans have gotten chesty with me for a while, and you know, and I take no satisfaction in being right when a team is disappointing, but it still is what happened.
Even with Cousins on the floor, you know, in the past they've at least been successful with him. They've been successful with the starters, and then their bench sucked. Like, that was their big problem the last 2 years. Even with Cousins on the floor, they have a -3.9. net rating, and their overall defensive rating is 106.7, which is right down at the bottom of the league. It's really just been a horrendous season for the Kings, and they are 7-20 in their last 27 games.
Speaking of horrendous seasons, the San Antonio Spurs. 16-11, 7-2 since the last time we did this, projected to have a 68-14 projected record. Wow. And 32% title odds, which is only slightly below the Warriors at 40.
So that seem high or low to you, 32%?
Seems about right.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, when we talk about their odds of beating Oklahoma City and beating the Warriors, I think it might even be... I mean, I think that they are being given not enough of a chance against the Cavs.
Right, I agree with you there.
Getting having like 15% of that remaining 70, you know, that remaining 28% or whatever it is, that is not allocated to the Warriors and Spurs. But I think they are probably being given too high of a chance of beating the Warriors, and especially because I think they have a semi-decent chance of losing to Oklahoma City as well.
Yeah, and Oklahoma City is a team that has given them trouble in the past with their athleticism and just supreme talents, but Kawhi Leonard being Kawhi Leonard will certainly help that.
Looked a little bit at their wings. Danny Green has just been broke from three again. He started off miserably during this season, got to be a little better during the middle part, and now he's down to 25% from three over his last 15 games. The good news is, though, that he still at least is getting guarded out there. And if they stopped guarding him and he still couldn't hit shots, then their offense would really grind to a halt, because they would just start double-teaming LaMarcus and Kawhi all the time. I mean, Tim Duncan already is a guy that you can double off reasonably well. Even Parker, not a guy who's going to hit you from three-point range. So they still need Danny Green spacing, if not his actually making shots. And, you know, as long as that 2014 finals that he had where he made, like, you know, 25 threes in the first five games or whatever it was, I think that still is enough to give him the reputation that he has to be guarded out there.
And one guy who has not been remotely disappointing for them is Kawhi Leonard. He's still been a monster. Last 15, same time frame, 35 minutes a game, 23 points, and still ludicrously efficient.
Yeah, and that's not even including tonight's game when he dropped 32 points in 24 minutes. Do you know 32 points is his career high?
Wow.
Isn't that weird that it's that low? I mean, I guess he just doesn't play that many minutes. Although he's been up there more a little bit recently, you know, getting into the 35-minute-per-game range. But he's just been very consistent, you know, and he just hasn't had those absolute wow games where you're like, all right, this guy is just blowing up. He's this incandescent scorer. And he doesn't have the usage either of some of the absolute top scoring threats, but they spread the ball around a lot more. And I thought maybe, you know, he's getting less efficient. No, over his last 15, 50% from two, 41 from three, 90% from the line. Still awesome.
And another guy that you've been watching more, he's only been on the team a little while, is Kevin Martin. I think he's looked pretty good. For what he is.
He's looked better. I would say he looked better. He's not hitting his three-pointers, but he is actually offensively a smarter player than he probably had a chance to show these last couple of years in Minnesota. I thought when he was playing under Rick Adelman, he had more of a chance to kind of do this stuff. He's good at moving off the ball, getting cuts, going backdoor. That's how he's gotten a couple of buckets with the Spurs. The fact that he has slowed down, though, is making it a lot harder for him to get his shot off because he has that release that's like way out in front of his body. And actually, like, Jeremy Lamb blocked one of those in the Charlotte game with his length that I think Martin was really surprised by. The other problem is that the way that Martin shoots the ball, where he brings it up so far in front of his body and on the left side of his body, that he basically, if he's going to his right, he can't shoot a jump shot at all. He can only shoot a jumper going left. And so if you force him right, he's got to kind of just like flail into you and hope to fall. And he's gotten a couple of those kind of, you know, Kevin Martin, Lou Williams style of plays where he feels the contact and just throws up some crap and gets a call. But his release is a little bit slow still. And defensively, he's been trying harder, but I don't think that he's, you know, I guess he could maybe be as good as like Marco Bellinelli. Like you could definitely tell he's giving more effort, especially since he's competing for playing time now and on a real winning team. So I'll give him credit for that, but I still don't think that he's going to play more than like 5 minutes a game, maybe, in a real competitive series.
Yeah, he's a part of a nice third unit, but he's probably not going to move the needle in terms of the playoffs. But it's nice to have him in case, because you never really know. I mean, that's one of the things we've talked about, is that, you know, that you're going to have to, sometime you might need a game from one of these guys, and it's good to have somebody who has experience, even though he doesn't have much playoff experience, does he? I know he's made it a few times, but not a ton.
Yeah, he hit a game-winning layup back in like 2006 in a Kings series against the Spurs, I want to say, like on a fast break. But then the Kings quickly fell out of it. The Rockets, I don't recall them making it at all when he was there. He had a very disappointing playoffs in 2013 once Russell Westbrook went down, and he was sort of miscast as the second scorer in Oklahoma City, and then obviously he never made it in Minnesota. So I want to say he's maybe made the playoffs like two or three times in his whole career.
It is two. He's made it twice, that series with the Kings, and then he made with Oklahoma City, which we just discussed.
So, great way to end the program, by the way. Just watching the Charlotte game, I was reminded of this. Tim Duncan is still just an unbelievable defensive player, despite the fact that he just never, ever leaves the ground. And just seeing the awe that rookies find when he just, like, blocks their shot without even jumping is just hilarious. Like, Frank Kaminsky went inside and tried to score on him a couple of times, and Tim must have just been like laughing at him inside. I mean, he just didn't even jump at all. Frank, not the longest arms, not the most explosive, just was swallowed up. Like, there was just nowhere to go. It looked like Duncan's standing reach was like 10'5", like guarding Kaminsky. It was just hilarious. It's always funny to see these young guys coming in the league and be like, oh yeah, that's Tim Duncan. I guess I'm not scoring over him at the rim, am I?
There are so many guys on this Spurs team that I genuinely love watching, and it doesn't really cease for me. Boris Diaw is another guy like that. Manu will be like that for his entire life, and I love that they're all on the team together.
All right, that'll do it for tonight's program. We'll be back on Sunday night with a special guest edition. You'll find out who that is then, but hopefully we'll line up some people to take Danny's place. Thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time.